The time has come to hear the truth about this tragic war. It's a dark day in our nation.
Sim.
they languish under our bombs and consider us the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their land and their crop. This is the role our nation has taken. It is time for all people of conscience to take a stand to call upon America, come back home.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're just finishing up Elizabeth Colbert's comments on humanity, which is driving a great wave of extinctions around the planet. And then after that, Ronald Wright talks about progress. He says, understanding humanity's pattern of progress and disaster will help us avoid the collapse of civilization as we know it. Ronald is interviewed by Pia Chotopati.
I mean, we humans revel in the wonders of nature. You know, we never cease looking at, loving to look at images, being out among them, looking at that beautiful sunset and all the rest. So we love this. Even in sort of vain pleasure terms, you would think we'd be driven to want to save and protect it.
Yes, and some of the stories that I tell in the book are about people who are going to extraordinary lengths. For example, one of the stories that ends the book is about a crow, a Hawaiian crow, which is also known as the alala. There are also only about 100 of these birds left on the planet right now, and one of them resides at the San Diego Zoo, where one of the people there who takes care of this bird actually literally strokes him during mating season, is trying to collect his gametes, we'll put it that way, to try to go and artificially inseminate some of the other existing birds. He refuses to mate in a sort of straightforward way with any of the female birds. So people are willing to go to extreme lengths. They're willing to, you know, pleasure a crow to try to preserve species. We are very, very committed to species preservation, and part of the sort of theme, I guess one of the themes of the book is really how much we do care, and at the same time how in many ways until this point, I guess you could say unknowingly, we have been, you know, wreaking havoc. And now the point of writing the book was to try to help bring that to public consciousness. And the question, when you have that consciousness, if the book succeeds at all, is, you know, what do you do with that knowledge?
I mean, things go extinct, but that's over vast, vast, vast expanses of time. The sun will blink out one day, but it's so far away. But this, you're pulling right into our time frame. And that seems, you know, okay, pleasuring the crow, that's great, but, you know, that's such a micro scale. Great for that, but we got the whole planet on the line here. You talk about, you raise the specter of a planet of dust and giant rats. That's not a place where human beings really want to hang out, and yet it's our home.
Well, that is exactly, yes, that you've hit the nail on the head, and we are living in one of these, you know, extraordinary moments in time, which will be inscribed, you know, in the geological record. One of the points that the previous caller made was that previous mass extinctions have been caused by these great, you know, geological forces, an asteroid, and in another case, probably a huge, huge series of volcanic eruptions in what's now Siberia. Now, we have become, many scientists would say, a geological force on the planet. We have taken over from the great forces of geology, and it's we who are, in a sense, in control, but we're not in control in the sense that we can anticipate and control what's going to happen. We've just become, many scientists also point out, we're running a great experiment on the planet, and it's an experiment whose endpoint we don't really know.
Elizabeth Colbert writes, right now, in the amazing moment that to us counts as the present, we are deciding, without quite meaning to, which evolutionary pathways will remain open and which will forever be closed. No other creature has ever managed this, and it will, unfortunately, she writes, be our most enduring legacy. Gary in Boscobel, Wisconsin. Gary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I've spent the last 40 years of my life trying to protect and preserve the last bits and pieces of the tall grass prairie ecosystem in the upper Midwest.
Great.
We've lost 99.9% of that whole ecosystem, so every scrap is a biological treasure, and it's getting more and more difficult to protect those tiny scraps. And I believe with all my heart, after seeing these struggles, that that the most precious thing that we have in the present day to leave for future generations is genetic and biological diversity, and we're wiping that out at such an incredibly sad rate that I don't really believe that humanity will be able to survive the next great extinction. We are destroying our life support system here and not even paying much attention to it, and thank you for the time.
I appreciate your call, Gary. Elizabeth, what about human survival in the context that you're describing, where we're the invasive species, we're bringing on the extinction? How do we fare in that?
Well, I very pointedly don't really take up that question in the book, to be honest, except in a very, very brief way. But it's certainly the question that comes to mind in most many people's minds. And I guess I would answer it in two ways, and one of which them is, you know, if you're the species that's taking over the planet, and you seem to be thriving, you know, there are 7.2 billion of us heading very rapidly to 8 billion people on the planet, heading almost certainly to 9. Then you would seem to be the species very well positioned, you know, to survive. On the other hand, one of the points that I make in the book, I quote a British paleontologist who points out that at these moments of mass extinction, of very high extinction rates, the rules of the game seem to change. And organisms that were dominant, for example, the dinosaurs, can drop out. You know, just the whole, all dinosaurs dropped out, not just
the kingpins of their time.
Exactly. And they had really been the dominant group for tens of millions of years. So there's no guarantee of future success when the rules of the survival game change. So I guess I'm going to answer that inconclusively. I certainly don't know. Obviously, no one knows.
Thomas in Bethel, Vermont. Thomas, you're on with Elizabeth Colbert.
Yes, hi, Tom. A very interesting topic today. I believe that what we as human beings, especially in the Western world, need to go back to is the connection to all living beings on this planet. This planet is our mother. We come from it, we go back to it, and we have totally lost the whole idea of protecting it. We're hurting it. We think, what does it matter if there's a million bats who die? It has nothing to do with me. But if you pull on one side, the other side will move. It's all a big yin-yang, more or less.
So how to get in harmony with it. Thomas, our time is short, but thank you so much for that. And if I may, Elizabeth, along those lines, Jekka writes to us on Facebook. She says, we are responsible for most, if not all, the destruction of the planet. Humans, the quote-unquote superior animals, have yet to find peace with nature, and until we do, nothing will change. Are we capable of finding that peace, that harmony, thinking it through and then acting on it to put ourselves in a harmony that would put things back on an evolutionary pace? Or is it just in our nature to disrupt?
I think that's, you know, very much the question of our time. And obviously answering that question when human population is at its maximum, you know, over 7 billion people on the planet is not easy. Even at times when there were many, many fewer people on the planet, you know, people were having a very significant impact. And very much, as I say, the reason that I wrote the book was to try to, you know, help spark that conversation. We're certainly not going to do it if we're not aware of what we're doing and if we're not thinking about what we're doing. We are very, very clever. That is what got us into this situation. And the question of whether our ingenuity and our resourcefulness and our ability to cooperate can also be used to minimize our impacts on other species is a question I think we're going to be wrestling with, you know, very much for the rest of the century.
West Palm Beach, Florida, Francis is calling. Hi, Francis. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I have to work very hard to stay hopeful, but I've always been struggling and discussing with people when I vote, because I'm doing everything I can physically to help. But when I vote, do I vote for, like, the Green Party, who doesn't have a chance of winning, or do I vote for whoever will win against a conservative person who doesn't seem to be interested in the environment? I know you can't, you know, say anything about particular candidates, but this is a fight I have with myself every election.
Francis, our time is short. Let us pick that one up as well. That makes it very, very, very practical in real world. Elizabeth, what do you say?
Well, I mean, the sort of, as you say, the practical politics of it are very, very difficult. And I wouldn't claim, you know, to have the answer to that. I'd say in a broader way that these issues, you know, issues like climate change have to be voting issues. Absolutely. Certainly nothing is going to change until that's the case. And when people ask me, you know, what can I do? One of the first things I always say is make this your political priority.
Elizabeth Colbert writes, it's estimated that one-third of all reef-building corals headed for extinction, a third of all freshwater mollusks, a third of sharks and rays, a quarter of all mammals, a fifth of all reptiles, a sixth of all birds headed toward oblivion. You've been out to look at it all. If we'd all been able to go along with you, do you think it would change our minds, our actions?
That's a really, really interesting question. I mean, one of the most spectacular places I have ever been in my life was the Great Barrier Reef, where we were looking at the effects of ocean acidification. And I wish everyone could see it. On the other hand, if everyone did go to the Great Barrier Reef, it would cause tremendous problems, too. So it's a tough one.
So sit down and think about it. A century from now, pandas, tigers, rhinos, only in zoos. Elizabeth Colbert writes about the whole big picture in her new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. You can read an excerpt at our website at onpointradio.org. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, also author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Elizabeth Colbert in Los Angeles with us today. Thank you very much for being with us. Keep it up. Keep talking to us. We need to hear it. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall. What did you see, my blue-eyed son? What did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues are all broken. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve. I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. And it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard. It's a hard rain gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. Body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. Oh, what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back about to fall in. I walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. The executioner's face is always well hidden. Where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is the number. And I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it, reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I know my song well before I start singing. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. It's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall.
And joining us now in Vancouver, British Columbia, Ronald Wright, author of A Short History of Progress. Hello there.
Hello.
Well, we're going to spend the next couple of nights talking about a word that's very important to humanity, critical, actually. And it's a word we bandy about a lot, but it's often misunderstood. So I want to start by asking you, Ronald, what do we mean when we're talking about progress?
Well, I think part of our problem is that it means a lot of different things to different people. It used to be, you know, go back a few hundred years and people talked about it in terms of spiritual progress or something fairly abstract. And then with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the scientific age beginning, you know, 2 to 3 centuries ago, then progress became identified very much with material progress. People have written entire books about what progress means. The trouble that I'm particularly interested in is that you can't really tell the difference between good progress and bad progress until it has played out, and by which time, if you've been mistaken in your idea of what true progress is, it may be too late by that point.
Okay, we're going to talk more about what good and bad progress means and what it means for us, but by trade, you're a historian and anthropologist, a backwards-looking guy, if you will, and yet you're talking about progress, something that is very forward-looking. What got you interested in looking at progress?
Well, initially, I think it was that I began to, you know, from my work years ago, studying ancient civilizations and seeing this pattern of rise and fall that has played out in different parts of the world repeatedly over the past many thousands of years. It occurred to me that we ourselves are not immune from this pattern, and in fact that the terrific acceleration of change that we have seen in the past century or two, which still seems to be accelerating, may in fact lead to a sticky end, just as too much progress of the wrong sort seems to have undone past societies, such as the Easter Islanders or the Maya civilization of Central America, or closer to home, in terms of our own traditions, the Romans.
When you think of progress, as a young child, when you were thinking of progress, what sort of do you remember about that?
I guess what I remember as a young child, I used to like tinkering with things, is that things often don't work the way they're supposed to. And true progress is when things actually get better. I mean, take cars, for example. When I was a child, cars were very unreliable things, and you sort of lugged around a toolkit so you could fix them at the side of the road if you had to. Now we have cars that are much better than that. So in a sense, we've made real progress there. But to pursue that theme, we now have so many cars all over the world that that very progression in transport is leading us to, you know, pollute the atmosphere, to have urban sprawl that's paving over farmland, to do all sorts of bad things. So, you know, the cars themselves have got better. That is real progress in a very limited sense. But the social and environmental consequences of having so many very good cars is quite another matter.
Your book is premised on questions surrounding Paul Gauguin, the 19th century French painter. Just take me through that. Why is Gauguin important to your conception of progress?
Well, this was just a lucky thing. I was in Tahiti, where Paul Gauguin did many of his finest paintings in the sort of 1880s, 1890s. And there on the wall of the Gauguin Museum is I believe it's a copy, but anyway, this huge canvas, which he titled, What Are We? Where Do We Come From? And Where Are We Going? And it seemed to me that those were very profound questions that are the same questions that historians and anthropologists and indeed physical anthropologists, the people who study human origins from ape-like ancestors, these are all questions that they ask. We now have a pretty good idea of what are we. Gauguin did not ask who are we, he asked what are we. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was asking that at a time not very long after Darwin had published his books, and the idea that we might be descended from apes was still very much in contention. And I think that the subsequent century, since he put it, what are we now have a pretty good idea of what we are. We do know that we are a species of great ape that has achieved an unusual level of intelligence in the sense of cleverness.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.